Now, to continue from the last shiur, we left off by Vayisa Esav Koloi Vayevch, that Esav raised his voice and he cried because he wanted, obviously, a bracha from Yitzchak. Now, we may ask four questions, very fundamental questions. And the first question is, what was the significance of the tears of Esav? The fact that Esav cried, I had mentioned previously, is an indication of regret, remorse of some kind. Besides understanding the tears itself, what did he regret or have remorse about? But what was the significance of the fact that he did have remorse in some fashion, that he did shed three tears? That's the first question we may ask. What is the significance of these tears when it says Vayevch and he cried? Another question we may ask, there's a very interesting Zohar. The Zohar says, Hadimors halolu, these tears of Esav, Hoiridu liYisrael leGolus, this is what has been responsible in bringing down the Jews into exile. Ukshayichu hadimors halolu, and when these tears will culminate, will end, how? Ayidei habechias shel Yisrael, because of the tears of Klal Yisrael, Israel, Yotzu meHaGolus, then the Jews will go out of the Golus. Now, that is a very profound Zohar. So I'd like to ask two questions on the Zohar. How do the tears of Esav put Klal Yisrael into Golus? How? What kind of a power did those tears have? That's the first question. The second question is, how does the tears of Israel, how does it counteract the tears of Esav to lead the Golus? What does the Zohar really mean? What is the profound idea in the Zohar? So those are two questions I asked on the Zohar. Now, let me ask one more question. Even if it was necessary, even if it was decreed that the Jews have to go into exile, number one. Number two, that they have to be dominated or subjugated by a foreign nation. And number three, that they have to be persecuted or afflicted by another nation. And those are three levels of exile, by the way. Still, the question is, why was it that Esav, who is represented, of course, by Rome, and of course today Esav is represented by Christianity, that is the modern-day Esav, or Western civilization, why is it that Rome was given the dominance over the Jews more than any other nation on earth? We have been in the shibud of Esav. We have been under his dominance, under his persecution, and we have been in exile for 2,000 years. More than any other nation on earth have we been under the dominance of Esav. Why? The Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, all of them have dominated Klal Yisrael. But their dominion is nothing as compared to Esav. I mean, if you think about it, the Egyptians were what, 210 years? The Babylonians were 70 years, whatever. The Greeks and the Persians were also whatever, relatively short amount of time. How is it that Esav has merited, if you want to look at it that way, to dominate, to persecute Klal Yisrael for 2,000 years? Why? And of course, that is a very important question to answer, because it answers the rise of Rome, and the continuous power of Rome, and the continuous power of Christianity. This is what that question, the answer to that question is what's going to answer this particular idea. Therefore, I have asked four questions, and let us see if we can go into and try to get an answer. Again, in order to answer these questions, let me recapitulate some of the fundamental ideas that we've learned until now, because that has tremendous bearing in terms of the answer of these questions. Okay, first, remember, Esav originally was a Masakin. He was able to influence the presence or the absence of the Ribbono Shel Olam in the Bria. In addition, he was a Ben Olam Haba, which of course is the contract that you bring me back into the Bria, this is what God says, and you will get Olam Haba, which is, I have explained many times previously. The concept, of course, of being a Masakin and being a Ben Olam Haba is the concept of being a Yisrael, a Jew. And that is what the Bris of Avraham is. That is the covenant that God made with Avraham. That's exactly what the contents are. Now, in addition, Esav was also an Ov. He had the Gedula of an Ov. He was as great as Yaakov. In addition, he had the task of the Inyan of Ben Yosef. and Yaakov had the task of the Inyan ibn Dovin. Now, this is basically what I had stated previously. In other words, Esav originally had claim to those brachos that Yaakov got. This is the upshot of what I want to say. Second, if you recall, he was equal to Yaakov. In other words, because both came from the midah of Tiferes, and the right side of Tiferes was Yaakov, and the left side of Tiferes was Esav. Therefore, of course, they were both others. Now, because of the rishus of Esav, because of his tremendous evil, we know that he lost everything. Not only that, but he lost the brachas of Yitzchak also. Because we know what the brachas mean. The brachas signify the permanence of the Inyan of Ben Yosef to the one who gets that bracha and to his descendants. That's what the Inyan of the brachas are. And we know that because of Esav's rishus, he lost it all, and of course it was given to Yaakov. Now, in addition, the tears that Esav shed, those three tears, registered a true remorse and a true regret. Because Esav had a real desire for the brachas. Now, we may examine what was the desire that Esav had for the brachas that he should actually have shed three tears. And actually, there are basically two reasons. Now, to say that Esav had charata, he regretted the loss of spirituality, ruchnias, permanently, is not probable. Esav did not regret the fact that he was not involved in ruchnias. He didn't regret that. However, there are two other reasons why Esav probably regretted the fact that the brachas were taken away from him and given to Yaakov. The first idea is because legitimately he wanted, or rather, he understood that the brachas themselves would empower anybody who got it with material wealth and dominance, power. And that's really what Esav wanted. He certainly wanted the aspect of the brachas which would give material wealth and abundance and also dominance over all other nations. This is certainly. In addition, and here we come into the greater idea of the remorse, that it wasn't merely some kind of selfish interest that he wanted the brachas, but Esav loved his father, as we can see from the tremendous Kibbutz of Aim. There was a real love there. And Yitzchak loved Esav, because it says, Vayerav Yitzchak es Esav. We know that. There was a true bond of love. Even though, of course, Yitzchak and Esav were on completely two different paths. He loved his father, Esav. And loving his father, he wanted blessings from his father. He wanted a bracha from his father. If somebody loves his father, then he wants his father to bless him out of that love. In other words, the desire for Esav to receive the brachas, blessings, from Yitzchak, is not only the content of the brachas, but it's also the fact that he loved Yitzchak and he wanted his father to bless him the way a father should bless his son, because he wanted to be a worthy son to Yitzchak. It's a real human reason why Esav wanted those brachas. In other words, he wanted the kibud over aim aspect of the brachas, that he who loved Yitzchak, he really wants his father to bless him. Therefore, basically, these are the two reasons why Esav had tremendous regret and remorse, and therefore shed tears. And we see how great was that regret, because it says, "Vayitzak tzo'oka gedolo ad mi'oid," that when Esav cried, he cried an exceedingly great and bitter cry. The Torah testifies to the regret that Esav had. And again, because of basically these two reasons. But there was a good reason also, and that is he wanted blessings from the father that he loved to be seen as a worthy son of those blessings. Now, this is basically why Esav desired the brachas, and therefore, of course, why had such tremendous remorse and regret on the fact that he did not receive those brachas. Now, once we understand that, we can now see what was beginning to happen. Remember, Esav originally had claim to those brachas. In addition, he desired those brachas for the reasons just stated, and therefore he had tears which indicated true regret and remorse. And we know, of course, he lost the original possession of those brachas because of his rishus. Now, let us go further. What does it say in the Chumash? It says, after he cried, Vaya'an Yitzchak Oviv, and Yitzchak answered, Vaya'an Yitzchak Oviv, and Yitzchak his father answered, and he said to him, behold, he gave him a blessing, Mishmani Oretz Yir Meshuvecho, that your dwelling place will be from the fat places of the earth. And Rashi says, and the Midrash says, that what is one of the most fertile regions in earth? And the Medrash says that is Italy, or the Italia shel Yovan, Magna Graecia, that's what it's called. In other words, the Greek part of Italy, that is one of the most fertile regions in Earth. In other words, the Greek part of Italy was really the southern part of Italy, which is Rome. Rome was located in the Greek part of Italy. And then, of course, once Rome became powerful, they themselves took it over. But the main idea is that the Greek part of Italy, of course, was the southern part of Italy, which is Rome. And that is what is referred to when he says that from the fat places of the earth, from the most fertile regions of the earth, shall be your dwelling places. So Yitzhak is actually telling him that the place that you should get, of course, will be Rome or Italy. And then Yitzhak says, and of course, you will enjoy the dew of the heaven. Then he says, and you will live by your sword. And you shall serve your brother. But when you will be aggrieved, when you will be in pain as a result of the subjugation to your brother, you will throw off his yoke from upon your neck. This is what Yitzchak says, of course, to Esau. Now, what is really going on here? What happened is that the tears that Esau had moved Yitzchak to do two things. As a result of the fatherly compassion that Yitzchak had, Yitzchak did two things. One, he blessed him. He gave Esav a blessing as a result of the fact that he had fatherly love and compassion for him. And I want to mention, that's why it says, Vaya'an Yitzchak Oviv. It doesn't say Vaya'an Yitzchak Vayimeh. And Yitzchak answered him and he said to him. It says, and Yitzchak his father answered him. The Torah is telling us that he answered him because of his compassion as a father. Now, he did two things as a result of those tears, because Vayan is in response to the tears. When Yitzchak beheld the real remorse, his fatherly compassion was evoked, and as a result of that, he did two things. He gave him the brachas, number one, and the second thing he gave him had profound significance, especially for Jews. What did he do to as a result? The second thing that Yitzchak did is that he revealed to Esav the weakness of Yaakov and his descendants. In other words, he revealed the Achilles heel of Yaakov and his descendants. How is it possible to remove the brachas from Yaakov and acquire it for himself and his descendants? He was megala that seed, that secret to Esav. Okay? Now, and of course, if Esav would take advantage of this, this acquisition would, of course, not be in the aspect of the spirituality of the brachas, because Esav, of course, doesn't want that at all. He's not interested in the union of Ben Yosef. He's not interested in the power of Tikkun. But, of course, if Esav would take back the brachas, it would be the aspect of wealth and dominance or power in the blessings. That's what he would take back. But in any case, Yitzhak revealed to him the secret of how to take it back from Yaakov and his descendants. And Esav and his descendants should, of course, get those brachas. Now, what was the weakness, or how can he do it? He revealed to him that if you want to take away the blessings, if you, Esav, want to take away the blessings from Yaakov, then here's what you have to do. The whole reason why Yaakov was able to take away the blessings from you, because you originally had them, is because of his sitkus, the fact that he observed the Tariq mitzvahs, and your rishus, because Yitzchak now realized that Esav was a Rasha. That's how Yaakov was able to take away those brachas. Now, if he stops his sitkus, if he does not observe the Tariq mitzvahs, then, since you originally were the owner of them, they were originally in your possession, right? And in addition, you have true remorse that you lost them. In other words, that you want your father's blessing in terms of kivud over aim and the fact that you love your father. Since he has no merit to keep these blessings, then you can be toveah him the dinah. Before the Rebbeinu Shlom, your malach can be toveah him, can demand apidin, that he should not get those brachas. Why? Because the whole reason why he got them is because of his sitkus and your rishus. But if he stops observing the commandments, then he is the same as you. There is no sitkus in Yaakov and his descendants. There is only rishus. in Yaakov and his descendants because he is not observing the Tarag Mitzvahs. Then since you really want them back, since you have a true remorse and a regret, that enables you to claim them back from him. Therefore, you can be Tovel Adino, you can bring him to the court of law, the heavenly court, and say, he does not deserve these brachas, there is no merit. I, my rishis, look at his rishis, and I originally own them, and I really want them back, because I really have some kind of remorse and regret. Therefore, what would happen then is that min hashamayim, the Rebbeinu Shem will arrange it in such a way that they will lose the brachas, or that aspect of the brachas, which is dominance, power, and of course, and material wealth, and they will be, in other words, they will be removed from Yaakov and his descendants, because there's no merit to keep them there, and they will be given back to you and your descendants, because you were the original owner, and you still want the brachas, you have a true remorse or regret, and the fact that Yaakov and his descendants have no merit, therefore they go back to you. In other words, the fact that Esav originally had possession of these brachas, and the fact that he really has remorse or regret in Mitzat Toiv, because he wants his father's blessing, allows him to claim these brachas back from Yaakov, to Tovel Din. And in other words, it is not Esav that forces the brachas away from Yaakov, it is Yaakov's own and his descendants' own lack of merit that allows Esav to win in the Din. Esav has the power to call him to a Din Torah, but what loses, what makes Yaakov and his descendants lose it, of course, is the fact that Yaakov and his descendants sin. Therefore, Esav has a claim back to the original possession of the brachas. This is the secret, the suid that Yitzchak told Esav because he had tremendous compassion on him. At this point in time, we can now ask, if it's true that Yitzchak revealed to Esav the secret of how to remove the brachas from Yaakov and his descendants and to take them back for him and his descendants, where do we see this indicated in the Torah? In other words, where do we see, first of all, Yitzchak's blessings to Esav? And the second thing is, where do we see indicated in the Torah the revelation that Yitzchak gave to Esav of the weakness of Yaakov? And as a result of that, of course, that Esav and his descendants can take away the blessings from Yaakov and his descendants. Where do we see that in the Torah? Now, it says in the Torah, V'yalchar b'cho sichye, and by your sword you shall live. This is what Yitzchak is telling Esav after he blesses him. V'yis'ochicho tavoid, and you shall serve your brother, namely Yaakov. V'hoyu shakev, v'hoyu ka'ashet torid, when you shall grieve, when you shall be pained, you will be able to take off, remove the yoke from upon your neck. Now, what does this pasuk really mean? When we learn this pasuk, it says, when you shall be pained or grieved. Rashi says that's what the meaning of torah is. Then you could learn pashut pshat means that because of the service that you have to give to your brother, when you shall be pained because you are in his servitude, then you shall remove his yoke. This is the way we would learn without Rashi. Rashi introduces a new element, a new idea. And he says that when it says, V'yesochicho tavoid, and you shall serve your brother, V'yohoyo kashe torid, and when you shall be pained or grieved, and you will remove the yoke from upon your neck, it doesn't mean that you will be aggrieved or pained because of the servitude of Yaakov, to Yaakov. But Rashi says instead, that you will be aggrieved or pained. Why? Because Yaakov and his descendants are not doing mitzvahs. They're not observing the Taryag mitzvahs. And therefore, you have tremendous pain. You are very much aggrieved. Why? Because they have the brachas. This is what Rashi says. In other words, that since Yaakov and his descendants are not doing mitzvahs, they are doing chatoim, they are not observing Torah, therefore they have no right to the blessings. Why? Since you were the original owner, because you originally had the Tikkun of Ben Yosef, which included, of course, these brachas. And since you want them back, because the tears indicate true remorse, as a result of that, you may throw off the yoke which they put upon you. In other words, you may remove their wealth, the material abundance and wealth, and their power from them. And you may take it back from you, to you, and your descendants. This is what Rashi says in terms of for v'hoyo kasher torid, and when you will be aggrieved. In other words, the pain which you will experience is not from his servitude, but from the fact that, look, they are not doing any mitzvahs, and they have the blessings. Why should they? They have no right to keep the blessings if they're not doing mitzvahs, because that's the whole reason why they could take them away. Since I originally owned them, I originally had claim to them, and I really want them back, as indicated by my tears, correct? Therefore, Esav is tremendously pained that Yaakov has the material wealth and abundance and power and dominion over all nations. Therefore, what Yitzchok is telling Esav is that uforaktu ulo meyatzav recha. Once they stop listening to the Torah, then you can reclaim those brachas, and therefore you could take away their power and dominion, and you can establish it for you and your descendants. Of course, this is what Yitzchok is telling Yitzchok is telling, of course, Esav. In other words, this is the seed of the weakness of Yaakov, and here we see it indicated in the Torah itself, in that pasuk. In other words, as long as Yaakov, as long as he and his descendants are righteous, as long as they observe Torah, they may have those blessings, the blessings of material wealth, material abundance, power, dominion over all nations. But if they are not thus, if they do chatoim, they don't observe the Torah, then they lose those brachas. And since you are the original owner, you have the original claim to them, and you want them back, as indicated by your tears, true tears of remorse, then you and your descendants will have them back. In other words, you yourself will achieve great power and material wealth. Now, we may ask, okay, we now understand where it's indicated in the Torah that Yitzchak revealed the seed to Esav about what the weakness of Yaakov and his descendants are, what their Achilles heel is, in the sense of taking the brachas away from Yaakov and his descendants and giving it, of course, to Esav and his descendants. But we can ask, is there a remez in the Torah? All it says is that you shall be aggrieved. And Rashi says aggrieved, why? Because they are not observing the Torah, correct? And therefore you can reclaim those the brachas. The question is there an allusion or remez in the Torah that what Esav is aggrieved at is the lack of observance of Torah amongst Yaakov and his descendants? This is the question. In other words, how do we know that Torah, which means to be pained or aggrieved, is because of the lack of Tariag Mitzvahs of Yaakov and his descendants? Maybe truly it's because of the fact that Esav is under the servitude of Yaakov. Pashut Pshat. The answer to this is, if you take a look at the word Kasher Torah, you'll see a beautiful remez. What is this remez? What does the word Torah mean? Rashi says the word Torah means, of course, to be aggrieved at, to be pained at, as a result of something going on. Hirsch says that the word torid or rid also comes from the verb yorad. Okay, yorad means to go down or to descend. And the word rid comes from that word. So therefore, torid would mean, therefore, descend. So now, let us take a look at this interesting idea. It says, v'hoyo ka'ashe torid, and it shall be that when you shall be pained or aggrieved. Let us read it three times, just like the amount of words in that phrase. V'hoyo ka'ashe torid, these three words. Let us read this three times, and you will see the conclusion, how Rashi reaches that conclusion according to the remez in the Torah. Let's take the first reading. V'hoyo ka'ashe torid. And when you, Esav, shall be aggrieved or pained at what? Let's read it again. V'hoyo ka'ashe torid. What will you be aggrieved at? V'hoyo ka'ashe torid, the second time, is when Israel, well, she shall descend, because torid means she shall descend. Okay, that's the second reading. In other words, what will Esav be aggrieved at? When Israel shall descend or go down. What will they descend or go down from? So let's read it again, the third time. V'hoyo ka'ashe torid. When you shall go down from the gematria of the word torid. Okay, what is the numerical sum of the letter values of the word torid? Is 614. When you shall go down from that value or that gematria, and to go down means you only have to go down numerical sum, right? The number one. Therefore, you arrive at the value of Taryag, 613. Okay, Therefore, the descent that Israel takes, of course, is from the Tariag Mitzvahs, because if you read V'hoyakash Torah the third time, and when you shall descend from the Gematria of Torah once, it comes out to Tariag. So therefore, you can read it like this, that Esav will grieve over the descent of Yaakov and his offspring from the Tariag Mitzvahs, the commandments. And that we see three times reading V'hoyakash Torah. V'hoyakash Torah once, and when you shall be pained or grieved. V'hoyakash Torah twice, what will be aggrieved at? That Israel or she shall descend or go down. And V'hoyakash Torah three times, what will you be aggrieved at? What does Israel descend from? V'hoyakash Torah, and when you shall descend or go down from the numerical value of the word Torah to the next value, which is 613, that is what Israel shall descend from, the 613 mitzvahs. So therefore we see an interesting allusion or remez in the Torah as to why Esav is pained, and also what is the source of these ideas, of course, from Rashi. This is a pshat, of course. This is a meaning in the Torah api remez. Now, let us go further. You may ask a very valid question until now. And that is, wait, it doesn't make sense. Just because Esav had the original claim on these blessings, because he was originally given the tikkun of Ben Yosef, and just because he wants them back, correct? Because the tears indicate a true remorse of the loss of these brachas. So what? It is true that his rishis lost these brachas for him. The reason why he lost these brachas in the first place is because he was evil, correct? And therefore, of course, it was given to Yaakov. Therefore, now that they belonged to Yaakov Avinu, they were taken away from Esav because of his rishis, and they were given to Yaakov because of his tzidkus. Now that they belong to Yaakov, even if he later stops the Tayag observance, even if he and his descendants do not observe the Torah, so what? Why should they go back to Esav? It belongs to Yaakov now. In other words, when Yitzchak gave Yaakov those brachos, he gave them unconditionally. He said that this is what you get as a result of the rishis, of course, of Esav. So then why is it that if Yaakov and his descendants, why is it that if they do not observe Torah, how does Esav have the power to take it away from Yaakov and his descendants and to keep it for himself? Based on what? On the fact that he once had them and he still wants them back? Yeah, too bad. You lost them. You were Russian, you lost them. Now Yaakov has them. And when Yitzchak gave them to Yaakov, it was unconditional. You've got them because you deserve them. So therefore, how in the world can Esav take them back? This is the question that I ask. And the answer to that is again indicated in the Torah itself. In the Torah itself, it says, before Yitzchak gives the brachas to Yaakov, it has a very interesting lashon. Yitzchak is about to bless Yaakov, and he says to him, V'yiten l'cho ho'elokim, let God give you mital ha'shamayim, from the dew of the heaven, and umishman ha'oretz, and from the fertile regions of the earth, and so on, and the tremendous abundance of dogon v'tiresh, of grain and corn, and so on. Rashi notes that it says, V'yitin l'cho ho'elokim. Holokim is the attribute of justice. In other words, we call God Elokim when God is acting as a judge, when he is evaluating the Bria, and of course, and when he's going to decide what he wants to do. That's Midas Adin. Therefore, when Yitzchak says to Yaakov, let God, in his attribute of justice, give these brachas, Rashi says that what he was really saying to Yaakov is that if you deserve these brachas, good. If you don't deserve the, in other words, if you deserve these brachas because you observe the commandments, good. Then let God give them to you because you truly deserve them, because God is acting in his attribute of justice. However, if you do not deserve them, then let God, who is acting as a judge, take them away from you because you don't deserve them. So in other words, we see, according to Rashi, that the Yitin Chohu Elokim, let God in his attribute of justice give you these brachas, means if you deserve them, you get them. If you observe the Torah, okay. If not, then the Rebbe Yisrael himself will take them away. This is what Yitzchak is saying to Yaakov. So we see that Yitzchak blessed Yaakov conditionally. It's interesting to note that when he blessed Esav, Rashi says, he did not bless him conditionally. It was unconditionally. Because all it says by Esav, Vayan Yitzchak Oviv, and Yitzchak his father said to him, Vayom Elov, he said to him, Hine Mishmani Oretz Yeh Moshevecho, that your dwelling place should be from the fat places of the earth, from the most fertile regions in the earth. He didn't say, if you are good, or V'yitein Lechohu Elokim. He said, no matter what you are, whether you be righteous or whether you are evil, when Yitzchak blessed Esav, it was unconditionally. However, when he blessed Yaakov, Rashi says, of course, when he blessed Yaakov, it says, V'yitein Lechohu Elokim, through Midas Adin, that if you are righteous, you will get the blessings. If you are not righteous, of course, if you are not observing the Torah, then of course you will lose them. In other words, these blessings of great dominion and power and material wealth are contingent. It's dependent on your actions, on your maisim. That, of course, is din. That's justice. Whenever something is dependent on your actions, and if you do the proper actions, you get them, and if you don't do the proper actions, you don't, that, of course, is always the concept of justice. Therefore, since Yitzchak gave to Yaakov those brachos contingent or dependent on his observance of the Torah, we now understand how Esav can take them away. In other words, if Yaakov sins, if he does chatoim, then he loses the blessings because of his own fault, not because of Esav. Because you can only keep those blessings if you are righteous. Right? If you are not righteous, you cannot keep those blessings. So therefore, if Yaakov does lose the blessings, it's because of Yitzchak's conditional statement. In other words, Yaakov will lose the blessings because of his own fault. He is not doing or he is not observing the Torah. In other words, Esav could never take them away or take these brachos away from Yaakov because he was the original owner and he really wants them back, as indicated by his tears. But since Yaakov and his descendants sin, and therefore this causes the Rabbeinu Shlom to take away the blessings from Yaakov, this is what's stipulated by Yitzchak himself. In other words, when he gave it to Yaakov, then obviously they can be lost because of Yaakov's actions. Now, since if Yaakov loses them because of his chatoim, the brochos are now ownerless. Who's got them? Who has the dominion now and who has material wealth in abundance? Not Yaakov, because he lost them because this was a stipulation of Yitzchak. Who has them? Now Esav can come and reclaim them as opposed to other nations. Because he originally owned them, correct? And not only that, but he wants them back as indicated by the tears. So therefore, it is only because Yaakov and his descendants have done chatoim that make the brachos ownerless. Once the brachos have no owner, so obviously Esav and his offspring, who originally had claim to them, and they exhibited, or rather Esav exhibited true remorse for them and wants them back, that is why Esav can get them. Not because he could take them away from Yaakov. Yaakov has to lose them first, and then Esav can pick up that which is ownerless. This is the way it goes. That is why Esav gets them from Yaakov. In other words, Yaakov sins is the first requirement. Therefore, the blessings become ownerless is a second idea because of the stipulation of Yitzchak. And therefore, Esav reclaims them as a result. In other words, he has first claim to them rather than any other nation because he, of course, owned them. This is the suid, the secret which was told to Esav by Yitzchak when he was giving him the blessing. In other words, the suid that he said is that those blessings that I gave Yaakov, you should know, is conditional. It's not permanent. He can lose them. This is what he told Esav. They are conditional to Yaakov. And if Yaakov loses them because of his own fault, his chatoin, then you can reclaim them since these brachos are now ownerless. And since you originally, of course, had the claim to those brachos, and because you really want them back, therefore you now can pick up ownerless brachos and you can take them as opposed to any other nation. Therefore, what do we see? We see that it's Yaakov's chatoim that caused the loss of the brachos, not Esav's claim or plea for them. And it only is when Yaakov loses them can Esav reclaim them. We now understand the mechanism by which Esav can take away the brachos from Yaakov. It is not because of Esav's claim. It is because of Yaakov's chatoim and his descendants' chatoim. Once they become ownerless, he now can come in, of course, and reclaim them. This is the mechanism that Yitzchak revealed to Esav when Esav asked him for bracha. Okay, so this answers the question. How is Esav able to take away? Because his claim is not strong enough. But the answer is he can only take it away because when Yaakov and his descendants lose the brachas because of their own fault, their own chatoim, and then Esav can come and claim these onerous brachas with far greater, of course, advantage and rights than any other nation besides him. We now understand the mechanism of how Esav is able to remove the brachas from Yaakov. Very important idea to understand, because that'll answer many ideas which transpire in history. Now, at this point, however, there are certain difficult questions that have to be answered as a result of what I just said. That the reason why Esav can remove the brachas from Yaakov is because the brachas to Yaakov are conditional. And therefore, once Yaakov loses them because he and his descendants don't observe the Torah, then Esav can then reclaim them for his own. But the whole reason why Esav could do this is not because of the justification of his claim. It's because of the condition that Yitzchak placed upon Yaakov when he gave him the brachas. This now presents us with three very difficult questions to answer. And the third is the most difficult of all. Now, what are these questions? The first question. Why is it by Esav, when Yitzchak gave the blessings to Esav later on, they're unconditional? There's no condition attached to them. If Esav is righteous or wicked, doesn't make a difference. He will always enjoy the fat places of the earth. This is what Yitzchak tells him. Whereas when he comes to Yaakov, he doesn't do that. He makes them conditional. What kind of obvious favoritism is this? Where by Esav, he makes the brachas unconditional. And by Yaakov, he makes them conditional. It seems that there's some kind of a favoritism going on here, that since he loves Esav more, as the Torah testified previously, he therefore, when he gives Esav the brachas, it's unconditional. But when he gives Yaakov the brach, of course, it's conditional. We have to understand what is going on here. First question. Second question. How can a father, could you imagine this? Remember, Yitzchak is the father of Yaakov and the father of Esav. How can it be, how can a father bless his son, or any son for that matter, saying this, if you deserve it, then you have wealth and power. And if not, if you don't deserve it, then you don't have them. Instead, if you don't have wealth and power and dominion, what do you have? You have poverty, and you have dominion and subjugation, and possibly persecution by other nations. In other words, if you deserve them, then you have wealth. And you have, of course, dominion over other nations. If you don't deserve them, then on the contrary, let poverty be your lot. Let subjugation and persecution by other nations be your lot. How can a father say that to his son? How? It's an incredible statement. When a father blesses his son, the love is in such a way where he says to his son, I bless you no matter what you do. That's love. It's unconditional. Yet you find Yitzchak saying to him, if you deserve it, then you're on the top. If you don't deserve it, then be on the bottom and stay there because that's what you deserve. What happened to all the fatherly compassion that Yitzchak supposedly has for his children? This is the second question. Difficult question to answer. Third question. If you thought the first two questions were difficult, the third question is even more difficult. What is the third question? Because the third question means that Yitzchak ripped out the fabric of the universe. How? What is the question? What were these brachas that Yitzchak gave Yaakov? These brachas, if you recall, are the permanence of the union of Ben Yosef to Yaakov and his descendants. Why? Because he gave them to Yaakov and his descendants that they should masakin the bria, they should correct the creation. From what? From the kilkel which was placed there by Adam Rishon. And these ideas, of course, I've spoken about many times. This is the entire reason why Yitzchak gave these brachas. But he thought it was Esav, but of course, in truth, it was really Yaakov at that point. But no matter what, he was giving away the permanence of the union of Ben Yosef, that Yaakov and his descendants should be able to masakin the bria, to fix, to remediate, or correct the universe as a result of the kilkel which Adam Rishon made, as a result of the damage, the pogrom that destruction which Adam Rishon placed into the Bria as a result. Now, therefore, what were the brachos? Therefore, the material wealth and power which Yitzchak gave to Yaakov is necessary because, for one who was assigned the task of Ben Yosef in order to subjugate the Sitra Achra, or to subjugate those klippas. How? How can you subjugate the klippa, the Sitra Achra, by having material wealth and power? Because when you dedicate this wealth, when you dedicate this material abundance, and when you take dominion over other nations and you turn it to the Ratzon Hashem, to the will of God, in other words, when you employ everything that you own, that you possess in His service, then you are subjugating the Sitra Achra and all the klippas. Therefore, what do we see? We see that these things which Yitzchak gave Yaakov are necessary for the task of Ben Yosef. It's necessary for the task of Ben Yosef in the sense that to masakan the Bria from its kilkel placed by Adam Rishon, the individual assigned or designated that task needs this material wealth, needs this abundance, needs this power. And by subjugating this to the Ribbono Shel Olam, he therefore subjugates the Sitra Achra. Therefore, what we begin to see is that these brachas are not merely blessings the way a father would normally bless a son, have material wealth in abundance and dominion. That is not what Yitzchak is saying to Yaakov. He is saying that you need these things in order to accomplish your designated task, to put it to the Ratzon of the Ribbono Shel Olam, to dedicate it to His service, and then you will be able to remove the kilkel of the Bria. Because that's the entire idea of these brachas. If that is the case, then it's a plia tsuma. It is incredible to understand why. If these things would be removed from the one who was assigned the task of Ben Yosef, namely, who was that? That's Yaakov. Then how can he do his task to masakan the Bria, to remove the kilkel? It comes out that when Yitzchak made these brachas, which is really the necessary requirements to do the job of what? Of Ben Yosef, to remove the kilkel and the Bria, when he made these brachas contingent, when he made these brachas dependent on the success of Yaakov with his task, in other words, if you observe the Torah, then if Yaakov and his descendants fail, what happens? If they fail to observe the Torah, in other words, to direct all of these possessions to the service of the Ribbono Shel Olam, it comes out that these blessings will be taken away from him by the Ribbono Shel Olam. In effect, the Bria can never be masukin again because there is no instrument by which a person can masukin the Bria. Therefore, the Bria remains without a tikkun, without an individual who can masukin it. And it comes out that the Bria will be destroyed because if the Bria cannot achieve a tikkun, there is no purpose to the Bria, therefore everything is immediately restored to Sohu Vavoyo. Because it cannot achieve this tikkun, to masakin that kilkel, and it cannot even masakin the original Chasson creation. So incredible as it may seem, how can Yitzchak remove the only instrument by which Yaakov masakin the Bria? What he's saying to him is, if you do your job, good. If you don't, then forget about the instrument, forget about the Bria, and it all goes back to Soyu Vavoyu. That is one of the most difficult questions to understand, because people think that the brachos are merely rewards or good things that Yitzchak wants Yaakov to have. No. What Yitzchak is transferring to Yaakov is the Inyan of Ben Yosef. Therefore, these are necessary requirements for the tikkunim of the kilkel, which is the whole Inyan of Ben Yosef. So if Yaakov and his descendants loses them because of his chatoim, what happens to the Bria? Didn't Yitzchak realize this? And of course he did. So what in the world is going on here? What is the pshat in this parsha in the Torah, which everybody so easily glosses over? In other words, it is almost incomprehensible to understand what is really going on. Because if this is the nature and the essence of the brachos, then Yitzchak in effect is indirectly destroying the Bria. Because as soon as Yaakov and his descendants cease from doing the Torah, then these vehicles by which they can masakan the kilkel of the Bria, which was made by Adam Rishon, are removed, and therefore the Bria has no way of being masukan, therefore it is ultimately destroyed. So we must understand what is happening. For this, I will answer it next week. Now, in the last shiur, I had ended off with a question, and the question basically is, to summarize, well, actually, I'd asked three questions, but the last question which I had asked, which is actually the most difficult of all to answer, is if Yitzchak made the blessings of Yaakov contingent on Yaakov's observance of the Torah, then since those brachos, those blessings, are nothing more than the permanence of the inyan of Ben Yosef to remove the kilkel in the Bria as made by Adam Rishon, therefore it comes out that you need those particular brachos in order to do your assigned task. So therefore, if Yitzchak is telling Yaakov that if you don't do your job, then you will lose your job, what Yitzchak is really saying to him is that if you lose your job, that's the end of the Bria. Because the Bria, if it has no tikkun, which would happen if Yaakov could not masakin the Bria, in other words, if Yaakov and his descendants could not masakin the Bria, what would therefore happen is that the Bria would be destroyed. Because if there is nobody able to masakin the Bria must be destroyed. And that we know from the Medrash, when the Rabbeinu Shalom said that if Yisrael is makabal the Torah mutov, if not, then the whole thing goes back to Toyu v'voyu. And we know what that means, is that there will be a nation called Yisrael who will be masakin the Bria, then the Bria, the creation, has a purpose. It will be corrected at one time in the future. Then I'll let it exist. However, if everybody fails and nobody picks up the thread or the task of being masakin the Bria, then the universe must be destroyed. Okay, this is what the Medrash says. Because there is no Yisrael. Therefore, of course, this is the question, which is a very difficult question to answer. Now, to proceed to answer, we have to know a certain idea, and that is this. In order to remove the kilkel from the Bria, from creation, one must remove the control that the Sitra Achra has over creation. Because the truth is that what is the kilkel which Adam Rishon did? He allowed the Sitra Achra, which is the Satan and the Yetzirah, it's all the same being, he allowed that to have control over the universe to a far greater extent than it had before the Chet of Adam Rishon, before the sin of Adam Rishon. Therefore, what the kilkel really is the tremendous influence that the Sitra Achra has in the universe, in the Bria. Therefore, in order to remove the kilkel from creation, one must remove the control that the Sitra has over creation, because the kilkel is identical to the control that the Sitra has over creation. That is what the kilkel is. Now, how does one remove the control that the Sitra Achra has over creation? In order to do this, obviously, one has to subjugate and subdue the Sitra Achra. That's the only way you remove his influence. Now, how do you subjugate and subdue the Sitra Achra? And the answer is that there are two variant forms. There are two ways or methods by which you can accomplish this task. In other words, there are two different directions that one can go in order to accomplish the task of subduing, subjugating the Sitra Achra. What are these two different directions? And once you understand this, you will begin to understand the entire pattern of history and the entire direction that Klal Yisrael goes, because it's always in one of the two directions. What are these directions? Either one will possess material wealth, one will possess tremendous abundance of worldly goods, and also the power and dominion over other nations. And as a result of that, one will dedicate everything that he has, all of these possessions, toward the service of the Rebbeinu Shlom, and not to turn this material wealth and abundance and power toward one's own needs for gaiva and taiva. In other words, a person won't engage in this material wealth that he has, and this kind of abundance and power, in order to fulfill his pleasure needs, his needs for power and arrogance. He won't do that. Instead, he'll take them and direct them toward the Rebbeinu Shlom. His service, he'll dedicate toward the Rebbeinu Shlom. He'll be a tzaddik and use these, like they say, he'll be ma'aleh them by using them for kedusha. That is the way that you subjugate the Sitra Achra. That is one way. Now, what happens if this way for some reason is not working? Okay, there is another way. The Rebbeinu Shlom gave another way of subduing and controlling the Sitra Achra. What is that way? What is the second mechanism for subjugating the Sitra Achra and thereby controlling the Sitra Achra and removing the kilkel from the Bria? And the answer is that one will be under the bondage of other nations, but you have to remain steadfastly righteous. You have to remain a tzaddik, which means you have to observe the Torah, or you have to suffer pain and suffering. at the hands of evil nations who are merely agents of the Sitra Achra. In other words, one either controls the world and all its abundance, which means that you are on top of the Sitra Achra or on top of the Klippas. Okay? You either do it that way, and you use these things for the Rabbeinu Shlom's Ratzon, for his service. Or the other way. One is controlled by the world. In other words, you are tachasak Sitra Achra. You are underneath the Sitra Achra, or the Klippas. You are controlled by him, as represented by the evil nations. But when you are in that circumstance, you fight for the Rabbeinu Shlom. How? By remaining a tzaddik, or righteous, under these nations, or by suffering at the hands of these nations. Therefore, these are the two ways that you can subdue the Sitra Achra. Two different kinds of conditions. Again, either you subdue the Sitra Achra by being above him and being in mastery of Ilam Hazeh, and therefore you dedicate everything to the Rabbeinu Shlom, that takes away or that controls the Sitra Achra. Or the other side, he controls you. He has his nations who represent him. He has them subdue you and subjugate you, and therefore you must remain righteous under them, or you must suffer at their hands. And that is the way you control or you subdue the Sitra Achra. In other words, these two ways of fighting the Sitra Achra and subduing the Sitra Achra, what really happens is that you remove the sparks, those nitzutis of Kedusha, of holiness, which he possesses as a result of the sins of mankind, and therefore which give him the awesome power over the world. These two ways are the ways of removing these sparks, or the control that the Sitra Achra has over the universe, by either being on top of him and controlling him and using all the wealth and power toward the Ratzon HaBoreh. Or the second way, of course, is to be under him, to be under those nations which represent the Sitra Achra, and remaining a tzaddik, and or suffering at their hands. These are the two ways that a person can control the Sitra Achra, subdue him, subjugate him, and therefore remove the kilkel of the Bria, the universe, which Adam HaRishon set in as a result of his chet. This is the underlying theory of how one deals with the Sitra Achra. Now, once we understand this, we can now understand what happened by Yitzchak. In other words, we see now that there are two directions to Kfiyas Hara Tachas Kedusha. In other words, there are two ways of subjugating or subduing the Sitra Achra. And that is, either you, of course, have control over the world and subjugate that control to the service of the Rabbeinu Shlom, or on the contrary, the Sitra Achra controls you and you remain at tzaddik, or you suffer at the hands of the agents that he sends. These are the two directions of Kfiyas Hara. Do not confuse them with Hispashtus Kedusha, because Hispashtus Kedusha, if you recall, is to spread holiness over the entire earth. Remember that the task of man is divided into two major divisions. Hispashtus Kedusha, to promote the idea that the Rabbeinu Shlom is the Yichud Shlitosa in the Bria. And there's also Kfiyas Hara, means to deal or interact or fight with the Sitra Achra. That's the second idea. The first idea is done by learning Torah, by spreading the word of God. The second idea, or Kfiyas Hara, is done by these two ways. So you really have two major divisions, and which is Hispashtus Kedusha, which is Mesakan HaChason. And you have Kfiyas Hara Tachas Kedusha, which is Mesakan HaKilkum. And the second way has two subdivisions. Okay, either you have material wealth in abundance and you use them, and dominion, and you use them for the Ratzon Hashem, or you suffer at the hands of the agents of the Sitra Achra and you remain steadfast, righteous, you observe the Torah, and you also, of course, go through Yisurin at the hands of these agents. This is a general division that I wanted to say so as not to confuse you from previous ideas. Remember, there are two major divisions, two major tasks, and the second division, the second task, has two subdivisions, which I had mentioned previously. In other words, both subdivisions, both methods, are really two alternative ways, two alternate ways to subdue the Sitra Achra, and as a result of this, to remove the Shlito, his control, and his hashpah, his influence over the physical universe. These are the two methods which I have previously mentioned. Now, in other words, the tikkun of the kilkul, that rectification of the damaging creation as a result of Adam Rishon's sin, can be dealt with in those two manners previously mentioned. Either to have material wealth, abundance, and power, and to use this in the Ratzon of the Rabbeinu Shlom, to use it in his service. Or to be in exile, subjugation, and persecution at the hands of evil nations, who are really the agents of the Sitra Achra. And this is the second way, of course, of dealing with the kilkul, that damage in the physical universe, in the universe itself, which of course was brought about by the chet of Adam HaRishon. Now, the truth is that the method of wealth and dominance, and I will call this Method A, Method A in terms of being mesaken the kilkul in the Bria, is really superior to Method B, which of course is the method of exile to other lands, meaning to be removed from Eretz Yisrael, and also subjugation under other nations and persecution at the hands of evil nations. That's Method B. Now, the Method A is really superior to Method B in removing the kilkul from the creation or from the Bria. Why is that? Because in Method A, there's an extensive use of free will. In other words, Bechira is employed in Method A because you are given a certain status, a certain position, a certain circumstance, which is wealth and power, and you act freely to use this situation to the service of the Rabbeinu Shlom. You dedicate it to the service of the Rabbeinu Shlom, and you do mitzvahs using these physical things, of course, as vehicles, or as instruments for the mitzvah itself. And in that sense, of course, you use Bechira, in other words, you make extensive use of free will. That's why Method A is superior. Whereas in Method B, it's much more limited. In other words, free will is far more limited than in Method A. Why? Because in Method B, which is the method of exile, subjugation, and suffering, there is much less free will employed. Because the Rabbeinu Shlom forces these things to happen to Jews. He forces the Jews, of course, to go into Golos, or exile, to be persecuted in the exile, and this is Method B. And of course, since he forces the Jews to suffer in this sense, you know, as the Golos, therefore, he is removing, obviously, their Bechira, in the sense that they must suffer, they don't have a choice. So therefore, even in the case where the Jews remain tzaddikim when they are in Golos, or if they just suffer, and for instance, if they don't remain tzaddikim, but they go through tremendous yisurin. In both ideas, when Jews are in the second method, then the Bechira is taken away in the sense that their suffering is what enables them to masakin the kilkul in the Bria. And since the Rabbeinu Shlom, of course, initiates this entire circumstance, since he forces these events to happen, obviously, of course, the free will of the Yidden is limited in the circumstance that they are in. The Yisurin will misakin the kilkul in the Bria. That is why the second method is inferior to the first method. Because whenever you have a method in which free will is the dominant trait, then obviously there's much greater merit and much greater schar that is done. So we therefore see the superiority, or the rationale of the superiority of Method A, which is wealth and dominance, over Method B, which of course is exile, subjugation, and persecution, in order to masakin the damage in the Bria, which was brought about by the Chet, the sin of Adam HaRishon. Now, we may ask now a question. When are Jews permitted Method A? We know that that there are two methods to masakin the kilkul in the Bria. We also know that the first method, that of wealth and dominance, is superior in doing this job, of course, than the second method, which is, of course, exile, subjugation, and persecution. We know that also. Now, another idea which I wanted to mention is the question of when are the Jews permitted Method A, and when are they permitted Method B? In other words, what determines which method will be used by the Jews to masakin the kilkul and the Bria? In other words, when are Jews permitted Method A, which is wealth and dominance, to remove the kilkel in the universe, in creation. And when our Jews forced to remove kilkel through the method B, which of course is exile, subjugation, and suffering. This is the question that I wanted to ask. Actually, we could ask it in the sense that when is the conditions which enable method A to be employed, when is that taken away from the Jews, and when are they forced into method B? This is the question. Now, the idea is, and the answer is, that when Jews observe the Torah, in other words, when Jews do the mitzvahs, then they are granted method A in removing the kilkel from creation, since they are exercising free will to do Hashem's ratzon. In other words, they are using the wealth and dominance given to them by the Ribbono Shel Olam, and they are exercising free will, and they are using it to remove the kilkel, of course, from creation. When Jews, however, do not observe the mitzvahs with their free will, in other words, when they don't do the Ratzon HaBerei, they don't observe the Torah, then they are forced into method B. And what is method B? Of course, the suffering in exile, subjugation, and persecution at the hands of evil nations. In other words, when they are not doing the mitzvahs, that is when they must, when they are forced into method B in order to remove the kilkel from creation. What I wanted to mention is also that even when Jews are forced into exile or subjugation and persecution at the hands of the nations, we have to remember that still, in other words, even though they are forced into the second method of bringing the tikkun to the kilkel, even in that method or method B, there are people who are also involved in method A, because we find that even among Jews, there are Jews who are very wealthy. They have tremendous material abundance, and there are many Jews that have a lot of power. So therefore, even though Jews in general have been assigned to the second method, because in general they have been doing chatoim, and therefore they are not worthy for the first method, you'll still find Jews in method B doing method A. In other words, they are being masakin the kilkel through their wealth and power. It's not an absolute where everybody's method A and or everybody's method B. Even if in general Jews are assigned to bring the tikkun of the kilkel in creation through method B, still you may find Jews enjoying in that sense method A, that they are being masakin kilkel in the Bria by their wealth and power. That's an important exception to note. Now, once we have this theoretical formulation, then we can now understand what Yitzchak was really doing when he gave the brachas to Yaakov. And with this, of course, we can begin to answer the three questions which I had posed just recently. Now, what was Yitzchak doing? Yitzchak was about to designate permanently the inyan of Ben Yosef on Yaakov, of course, who he thought was Esav, but in fact it was Yaakov. Now, we know, of course, that the inyan of Ben Yosef is the inyan, or the matter, or the concept of the tikkun of kilkel in creation. Therefore, if Yaakov Avinu was about to get this permanently, what it means, of course, is that what he was about to get permanently, of course, is the inyan of the tikkun of kilkel in creation to Yaakov Avinu. Now, therefore, as a result of that, he gave him method A to do this task, which, of course, is wealth and dominance. In other words, Yitzchak was not given to Yaakov merely a blessing of wealth, material abundance, prosperity, power, dominance over others, in order to do good to Yaakov as his son, which is what people think. He wasn't giving him a bracha that you should have a great life, a relative ease and tranquility, and a lot of prosperity and success. That is not what Yitzchak was doing to Yaakov. What he was given to Yaakov was the method A to do this task. And of course, method A to do this task encompasses wealth and dominance, because that is one of the ways of being masakin the kilkel in the Bria. Therefore, we see a fundamental idea, a fundamental concept, that you should know that the blessings of the Ovos to their sons is not a blessing that they should enjoy life. That is not what it is. What it is a blessing in regards to the tikkun of the Bria, in regards to the tikkun of both the chesaron, the original deficiency, and the kilkel, that damage which Adam Rishon made in creation. This is what the bracha of an ov to his son is. That's what they do. In other words, they give a bracha to their children, Avram to Yitzchak, Yitzchak to Yaakov, or whatever, and that bracha, of course, is a blessing that their children should be able to masakan the chason and kilkul in creation, thereby enabling creation to fulfill its intended purpose, therefore, of course, satisfying the will of the Rabbanu Shlom. This is what a blessing from an Av to a son is all about. Not as most people think, that is merely a blessing to have a peaceful and tranquil and successful and prosperous life. But the blessing involves, of course, the entire purpose of creation, which is, of course, to bring about the tikkunim of creation. This is what the blessing of an Av is all about. Therefore, in Yitzchak's case, that is what he was blessing Yaakov Avinu. He was giving him wealth and dominance in order that he may be misakin the kilkul through method A. Very important idea to understand. Now, this is what Yitzchak was doing when he was given the brachos to Yaakov. What we have to understand, however, is that if Yaakov Avinu, and of course he and his descendants, because his descendants get the same bracha or same method that Yaakov gets, if Yaakov Avinu and his offspring, if they sin with this method A, which is wealth and dominance, then what happens? Then instead of being mesakin the Bria, he's more mekalkel the Bria. He creates a further damage in creation. In other words, since he and his descendants have the power to be mesakin the Bria, to correct or remedy or rectify the Bria, or mekalkel the Bria, or in other words, to damage the Bria, then if that's the case, if he sins with this wealth and dominance, which he should have been using for the first method to remove the kilkel in the Bria, then instead of tikkun, he will bring more kilkel to creation. As a result of that, Yitzchak said to him, V'yitin l'cho ho'elokim, let God, in his attribute of justice, in other words, let God, as a judge, give you method A, wealth and dominance, to remove the kilkel from creation. But as a judge, if he sees you sinning and doing chatoim, and as a result of the course, that means that you are inflicting greater damage on the Bria, then let him take it away from you, so that you don't destroy creation more than what you, what then of course, than what should be. Instead, let him give you method B, which is of course exile, subjugation, and persecution to masakin creation. This is what Yitzchak was doing. He said, Yaakov, you will get wealth and dominance, which is method A to masakin the Bria. But remember, if you don't do that, if you or your descendants sin, then you cannot have method A, because instead of being masakin the Bria, you're going to be makalkal the Bria. Therefore, he made this method, which is wealth and dominance, dependent on the attribute of God's justice, because he wants God to sit in justice and evaluate, are the Jews doing the tikkun according to method A properly, or on the contrary, are they bringing chuban, pegam, and kilkel to the Bria? In other words, we see therefore that of course Yaakov Avinu and his descendants have to be masakin the Bria. In any case, it doesn't make a difference. You and your descendants have to masakin the kilkel in any case, but it is up to you which method applies. If you listen to the Torah and you do the mitzvahs, then you can be given this first method to masakin the Bria, which is wealth and dominance. However, if instead of doing the mitzvahs of the Rabbanu Shlom, you do chatoim, and as a result of the chatoim, of course, you, instead of being masakin the Bria, you are going to be makalkal the Bria, then the Rabbanu Shlom, in his attribute of justice, will take away this method, and of course, and give you, of course, the inferior method, which is, of course, method B, exile, subjugation, and persecution. This is why Yitzchak made this method, or these brachos, contingent on the merit or schus of Yaakov and his descendants. And he said, let the Rabbanu Shlom sit in judgment over you when you are doing this particular method to, of course, remove the kilkel in the Bria. Now, with this, we now understand why is it that when Yitzchak gave the brachos to Yaakov, he said, V'yitein cho ho elokim, and may God, in his attribute of justice, give you the following blessings. Whereas later on, by the Birkas Avram, he uses another shame of Hashem. He uses another name of God to give the blessings of Abraham or Avram to Yaakov. What do I mean? In Perik Chof Ches and Pasuk Gimel, it says there, V'kel Shaddai, and may God Almighty Yivorech Oischa bless you, V'yafrecha, and he should make you fruitful, V'yarbecha, and of course, and he should make you multiply, V'yoyisu l'kal amim, and you should be for an assembly of nations. Then he says, V'yitin necho es birkas Avram, and may he give you the blessings of Avram, necho u'rezaracha, to you and your children, itoch with you, l'rishtecha es eretz migurecha, to inherit the land of your wanderings, asher nosan elokim li'Avram, which God, of course, gave to Avram. So the question is, why is it over here? He says, "V'kel Shaddai yivorech oischa," that God Almighty should bless you, and he gives him the blessings. Okay. And previously it says, "V'yitein choholokim," that God, in his attribute of justice, should give you those blessings. In other words, over here, where he gives the agreement that the Rabbeinu Shlom made with Avraham Avinu, and he gives it to Yaakov, and what was that agreement? Of course, that Avram and his descendants will be able to masakin the Bria, creation, and as a result of that, of course, get it Olam Haba. When Yitzchak gives this particular Bris Avram, the covenant of Avram, which of course is the definition of a Jew, when he gives it to Yaakov, this agreement that Yaakov and his descendants can masakin creation and get Olam Haba, when he gives it to Yaakov and his descendants, then the question, of course, is, why is it that he uses the name of V'kel Shaddai should bless you and give you these brachas? And of course, previously he uses the name of God, which designate God as a judge. This is the question that I'm asking. But now we understand. When Yitzchak gives the previous blessings to Yaakov, what is he really giving him? He's giving him the method of tikkun of kukul in the Bria. So therefore, when Yitzchak gives the methods for tikkun of the kukul of the Bria over to Yaakov, then he wants the selection of a particular method to be dependent on the merits of Yaakov. In other words, therefore, he invokes the attribute of justice of God, of the Rabbeinu Shlom, to make sure that the merits of Yaakov, or their absence, will determine which method is going to be used by the Jews to remove the kukul in creation. That is why, when he's giving out these brachos, which is really the method to masakin the kukul in the Bria, he invokes the name of God, which indicates the attribute of justice. However, but when Yitzchak gives to Yaakov the agreement between Hashem and Avram, okay, when he gives this to Yaakov and his future descendants, then he invokes the name of God that signifies absolute power over everything, even Midas Adin, and also an abundant and plentiful mercy to ensure that whether Jews have merits or not, whether they observe the mitzvahs or doing chatoim, sins, then they will always be in the agreement between the Rabbeinu Shlom and Avraham Avinu. This is what he does. In other words, when Yitzchak is given the bracha of Avraham to Yaakov and his descendants, then he uses the name of the Rabbeinu Shlom that signifies that God has absolute power over everything, even din, and of course he has an abundant amount of compassion in Rachmanis. Why did he do that? Because he wants to make sure that even if the Jews don't have schusim to be worthy of this test, in other words, they are not doing mitzvahs, instead they are sinning and they are not worthy, that they will always be in the agreement between the Rabbeinu Shlom and Avram. And we know what that agreement is, that you will have the ability to masakin the Bria, creation, and as a result, you will get Olam Haba. That is why Yitzchak uses that name, which designates that particular attribute of the Rabbeinu Shlom. Now, we see therefore that what Yitzchak is really trying to do is to make sure that the Jews always will be involved in being masakin the Bria, rectifying creation, whether it be by method A, which is wealth and dominance, or whether it be by method B, of course, which is exile and subjugation and suffering. What he does is he invokes the name of God, which will ensure the continuity of the Jews being part of the covenant that God made with Avraham Avinu. That is why he uses a name which refers to God or signifies the attribute of God's awesome power over every single thing he created, even the attribute of justice. That is why he used that name, because Yitzchak knows that there will come a time when Jews will not be worthy to do this task. Therefore, Cholila v'chas, they can lose the entire power of Tikkunim. Just like we see that Esav, because of his riches, lost the entire power of Tikkun to Mesach and the Bria. So therefore, when Yitzchak gives this blessing to Yaakov, he says, V'kel Shaddai yivorech ischa, God in his attribute of absolute power should bless you, and he should give you the Birkas Avram, the covenant that he made with Avram. That's what he should give you in his attribute of awesome power, even over the Midah of Din. So therefore, even if you are not found worthy, he should still include you in the power of Tikkun in the Bria. So therefore, if you do not deserve method A, let him come up with method B. This is why Yitzchak gave the brachos of Birkas Avram in the name, or the name of God, in terms of Ekel Shaddai. That's why. In other words, he wants to invoke the continuity of the Bris of Avram over Jews. And we know, of course, what that really means is that he wants to invoke the continuity of Anhogas HaYichud, that backup system, which the Rebbeinu Shlom does in order to make sure that the creation will be rectified by the actions of the Jews, whether it be through their mitzvahs, their tshuva, or through their yisurin, if you recall. Now, the aspect of Anhogas HaYichud was really assured to Avraham Avinu at the time of the Bris Bein Absar. As I had mentioned in the previous Shurim, what do I mean? How did the Ribbono Shel assure Avraham that he would always protect the Jews, he would always allow them to be in the covenant that he is making with Avraham? In other words, that they will always be in the position of being able to masak in the Bria, even if they are not worthy, and thereby be zeicha or merit olam haba. How did the Ribbono Shel Olam assure Avram of this idea? The answer is that this is metaphorically symbolized by how the Ribbono Shel Olam presented himself to Avram when he passed through the pieces of the animals that Avram cut up for the purposes of establishing an agreement or a covenant with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Because if you recall, Avraham Avinu cut up different animals and birds, and he cut them in half, and he placed them, each one facing the other, and the Ribbono Shel Olam passed through them. That's what it says in the parasha of Bris Bein Absar in Breishis. What did he pass through them as? It says there that the Ribbono Shel Olam passed through as a lapid ash, as a flaming torch, a torch of fire. And he also passed through as a tanur oshan, a smoking furnace. These are the two ways the Ribbono Shel Olam passed through those pieces, which symbolized, of course, that God was making the agreement with Avram that he would always be the Mesakin and therefore Zeichat Olam Haba, and also, of course, his descendants also. Now, the Ribbono Shel Olam passed through this in two different forms. And we can ask ourselves, what is the significance of the fact that the Ribbono Shel Olam passes through that in two different forms? What does that mean? What is the soid, or the secret, which the Torah conceals from us in terms of why God is passing through these two pieces, which of course symbolizes the agreement of God to Avram that he and his descendants will always be the Mesakin and Bizeich to Elmahba? Why is God passing through in two different forms? And the answer to that is that Rashi says that the smoking furnace is symbolically Gehenim. That's what the smoking furnace represents. Gehenna passing through the pieces. In other words, what we now see is that the Ribbono Shel Olam revealed to Avram this startling idea that the Ribbono Shel Olam will always be the God of the Jews, no matter how they conduct themselves, whether they have merits or whether they don't have merits, and therefore they're not worthy to really to undertake the task of being Mesakin and the Bria. Therefore, it proceeds like this. If they do the mitzvahs, if they do the will of God and they observe the Torah, then he appears to them as a flaming torch, which is a brilliant light, which is what's called Ha'oras Panov, the shining face of God, in response to the mitzvahs that they do. In other words, you do mitzvahs, you reveal the light of God through the creation, therefore God will appear to you as a brilliant torch, a shining light, Ha'oras Panov. However, if they don't do this, if they don't do the mitzvahs, and they don't observe the Torah, instead, if they do chatoim, they do sins, then the Ribbono Shel Olam will appear to the Jews, how? As one who will subject them to suffering and punishment. And this is symbolized by the image of Gehenna. In response, of course, to the Echatoim or their Averis. In other words, the Ribbono Shel Olam is telling Avram that I will always present myself to the Jews, no matter what, as their God. However, I will look two different ways depending on their actions. In other words, if they do the mitzvahs, then I will appear to them as a brilliant light, in response to the light that they usher in the Bria, Horas Panov. However, if they don't do mitzvahs, they do sins, I will appear to them as a punishing father, Gehenim, that's what it symbolizes, one who will subject themselves to the fires of Gehenim, or the sufferings that they must endure at the hands of nations. Therefore, I will subject them to the Yisurin, the punishment or the exile, and in that way I will appear to them. But you will now notice that in both ways they can massacre the Bria. In other words, they will always be able to massacre the Bria, to remove the Kilkel, this and get Olam Haba. But it can be done either through mitzvahs, and therefore God will appear to them as a shining, brilliant torch. And if you recall now, this is method A. This is the wealth and dominance that they can bring the Tikkun of the Bria. Or the Ribbono Shel Olam will appear to them, of course, as a father who punishes. And therefore, it is through punishment, suffering, and persecution, which is method B, that they will massacre the Kukul in the Bria. And that is, of course, Hanhogas HaYichud. So we see that the Ribbono Shel Olam is revealing to Avram the two ways he will present himself, which is really method A and method B, and it depends on the actions of the Jews. If they do mitzvahs, then I will appear as a brilliant torch, Haras Panov, which of course is method A. If, however, they do chatoim, they do sins, then I will appear to the Jews in the illusion of Gehenna, which means I will punish them, I will subject them to exile, subjugation, and persecution, which is method B, and in that way they will massacre the Bria. But don't worry, Avraham, they will always massacre the Bria, whether I have to appear to them as a lapid ash, a torch of fire, or whether I have to appear to them as a smoking furnace, as the image, of course, of Gehenna. They will also be able to massacre the Bria. And in that way, the Ribbono Shel Olam guaranteed to Avram that the Jews will always be in the covenant that he is making with him. They will be able to massacre the Bria, and as a result of that, get Olam Haba. But it is up to the Jews which face God shows them. Either he shows them the face of a tremendous burning torch, because they do mitzvahs, or he shows them the face of Gehenna as a punishing father, because they are massacring the Bria. How? They are massacring the Bria through Yisurin, to Golas. But they will always be in the position of Tikkun, and therefore they will always be in the position of being able to get Olam Haba. This is what those two forms that the Ribbono Shel Olam takes when he passed through the pieces, this is what it means. Now, as a result of all this, we now see that when Yitzchak is giving Yaakov the agreement with the Ribbono Shel Olam that he made with Avram, in other words, the Birkas Avram, that Bris of Avram, he uses the name of God, which signifies the supreme or absolute power over all creation, which is Teva, natural law, including the attribute of justice itself, the absolute power over justice itself. Therefore, as a result, the Ribbono Shel Olam can give sufficient mercy to Jews, because he is all-powerful, to enable them to massacre the creation through method B, which is Hanhogas HaYichud, and therefore earn Olam Haba. But previously, of course, when he gives them the method, he wants that method to be contingent on their acts. Therefore, he invokes the name of God, which, of course, is the attribute of justice or God in terms of the way he is a judge. Now, one more point I have to clarify. How do we know that the name of God, Kel Shaddai, signifies the absolute power over all creation, including Midas Adin, and that it indicates, therefore, that God has the power to give sufficient mercy to whomever he wants? The answer to this is that Rashi says in Brachos, in Perek Mem Gimel, Posuk Yud Dalet, over there it also says, Yaakov Avinu is saying to the brothers that they should go back to Mitzrayim, to Egypt, and he uses the name Vekel Shaddai, that God Almighty should protect you, whatever, and should enable you to rescue, of course, Shimon, even though you bring Binyamin, of course, to Mitzrayim. Rashi says there that what does the name Kel Shaddai mean? It means Kel, God, Shaddai, who is sufficient. What does it mean he is sufficient? In other words, and Rashi says this, that he has sufficient abilities, he has sufficient power to counter any force, any natural law, even justice itself, which is Midas Adin. Therefore, of course, he can exercise sufficient mercy for anybody who needs it. And that, of course, is the entire union of Anonymous Yichud. Therefore, the name of Kel Shaddai says Kel Shaddai, God who has sufficient power to overrule any attribute. He can do whatever he wants. And even though justice demands that the Jews who are sinning should not be, of course, Zeicha to Olam Haba, he can overrule that. And he can enable them to get Olam Haba. He can enable them to massacre the Bria, the Kilkul in the Bria, through another method, which is, of course, method B. And therefore, he appears to Avram, of course, as that smoking furnace. In other words, the name of Kel Shaddai indicates that God, who is sufficient in his absolute power to do whatever he wants, which of course means Hanhogas Ayuchad. That is why Yitzchak, of course, used it on this particular occasion. I just want to mention another idea in Kel Shaddai, that this name indicates the absolute power of the Rabbi Shalom over all nature, natural law, over all forces, and even over Midas Adin, because we see the same term, the same name of the Rabbi Shalom when the Rabbi Shalom appears to Avram when he wants to give him the bris milah, the mitzvah of circumcision. And it says, Vayhi Avram ben Tishim Shona, V'seisha Shonam. And Avram was 99 years old. Vayira Hashem el Avram, and God appeared to Avram, Vayir Me'elov, and he said to him, Ani Kel Shaddai, I am God the Almighty. His halech lefonai, go before me, ve'ye somim, and be perfect, be whole. So he is appearing to Avram Avinu in the name of Kel Shaddai. Because, if you recall, the Rebbe Shem appeared to him in the attribute that he can overcome any resistance at all. And Avram Avinu was 99 years old. How in the world was Avram Avinu going to give birth to a son? Besides that, if you recall, that the astrological signs were against Avram, because Avram said to the Rebbe Shalom that according to my mazel, my astrological sign, I cannot give birth. So the Rebbe Shalom said, don't worry, Ani Kel Shaddai, I am God Almighty, I am the Rebbe Shalom who has absolute power over all nature, over any force, over any mazel, over even Midas Adin, and I will change natural law, and I will remove the astrological influences that prevent you from having a child, and I will remove the natural reasons why you can't have a child, because you're, of course, 99, and of course Sarah can't have a kid because she doesn't even have the ability to have children anymore. I will overcome them because I am the absolute power, and you, of course, will have children. And, of course, that is why he uses that name, Kel Shaddai. And, of course, this, again, is in agreement with what I'm saying, and according to what Rashi is saying, that name refers to the absolute power of God, of the Rebbeinu Shalom, over anything he created, including Midas Adin. And if he wants, he can overcome anything, subjugate it, and of course introduce tremendous mercy and compassion and tremendous chesed. This I bring down as a corroboration of what the name Kel Shaddai really signifies. Kel, God, Shaddai, who is sufficient in his power to overcome any force, any natural law, any kind of aspect in his creation. That's what Kel Shaddai really means. And I will continue next week.